Good morning. You can make yourself comfortable. We are now ready for the argument in the third case on our calendar this morning. And that case is Richard Leo Bassing, petitioner appellant, versus Barbara Lorraine Bassing, respondent, A220207. Welcome to both counsel. I apologize if I mispronounce the names of your clients. I'm sure you'll correct me when you begin your arguments. So we ask that you make your arguments from the center podium this morning. Apparently, that is necessary in order to make a recording of the arguments this morning. And in the interest of the quality of our recording, I also ask that you please introduce yourselves and the parties you represent before you begin your arguments, and let us know if you have any preferences as to how we identify you or your clients, including pronunciation of names. Appellant will have 15 minutes to present, and then respondent will have 15 minutes for argument. Appellant will then get 5 minutes for a rebuttal argument. And with that, you look like you're both settled in. I think we can get going with counsel for the appellant.
May it please the court. My name is Glenn Bruder, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Richard Bassing. This is an appeal from a July 2021 dissolution decree ending the party's 50-year marriage. At the time of the trial, appellant was 73, respondent was 70. The issue presented is whether the district court judge abused his discretion in awarding a disproportionate share of the marital estate to respondent. I'll be candid. Appellant's position is that there was no rational basis for awarding respondent somewhere between $258,000 and $360,000 more in the marital estate than her husband. Our position is that this property division can be rationally explained only as a product of the trial judge's distaste for appellant.
The findings and order itself said that it was in lieu of spousal maintenance. So why, and the district court made findings on expenses and income, et cetera. So why does that not justify it? I didn't see that in your briefing, actually.
It actually is in my brief, Your Honor. And it's in the initial brief, and here's the reason why. First of all, what the judge actually said was the disproportionate award is justified in this instance because I'm not awarding sanctions against appellant in the form of attorney's fees, and I'm not awarding spousal maintenance. Now, neither of those arguments individually or collectively justifies what the trial court judge did. First of all, with respect to declining to award attorney's fees as sanctions, sanctions can be awarded pursuant to specific statutes which require specific findings from the judge, none of which he made in this case. But more importantly than that, it wasn't factually justified under the facts that it had been presented.
You've got a client where there was a witness on the stand saying that your client suborned perjury. The district court made findings about how your client exacerbated the costs to wife of discovery. So why does that not justify it? I mean,
because
conduct-based attorney's fees, they're awarded all the time.
Because the total attorney's fees, first of all, I'm not going to agree that my client suborned perjury, but secondly, assuming that's the case, the respondent's total attorney's fees were $35,000. Of those $35,000, she paid $20,000 by breaking into my client's home, taking $19,000 in cash from a safe, and tendering it to her attorney for payment of fees. Those were, at minimum, marital funds that she took from my client and then used to pay her attorney. In addition, it's undisputed that during the course of the trial itself, or the proceeding itself, Mr. Bassing paid another $8,500 of his wife's attorney's fees. So the maximum amount of any sanctions by the time the trial was over that the judge could have awarded for attorney's fees would have been substantially less than $10,000.
What about concern that your client was not revealing assets? I mean, there's an entire section of the district court's order entitled Husband's Failure to Disclose that lists fact findings about assets that were not disclosed when they should have been.
Let me begin by saying that if you look at the trial record or the district court record, you'll see that the judge virtually adopted the respondent submissions. So essentially, this is the draft dissolution decree that the wife submitted at the close of trial. But I think that the most telling testimony that was presented during the trial, and that appears at page 21 of my brief, is that of the respondent herself. And she's asked a series of questions by the trial counsel. Why should the court grant you more than half the marital estate? Because he has hidden assets. So his conduct and those assets he hid, what were those? He's very clever and very dishonest. We didn't find them. You didn't find any hidden assets? No. So there are no hidden assets in this case, Your Honor. And the entire marital estate is there for division. Now, in this instance, the judge said, judge used the decision not to award sanctions as one prong of the justification for a disproportionate award. That clearly doesn't stand because the sanctions would have been nowhere close to $258,000 or $360,000, depending on which set of figures you want to take. Well, spousal maintenance. There is some support in Minnesota case law that says that a decision not to award spousal maintenance can justify a disproportionate award, provided the spousal maintenance award would have been roughly equivalent to the disproportionate division of the marital estate. That is not the case here. These are two people in their 70s. They're both, the respondent's entitlement to spousal maintenance at the outset is intrinsically questionable since they're both in exactly the same position. They're retired, neither one is going to be working, both of them have health issues. But even assuming that there was some arguable claim for spousal maintenance on the part of respondent, what was it? The judge made findings that her income was $2,400 a month and her monthly expenses were $2,793 a month. That's something like $300 or $400 a month in a shortfall. There are no findings that Mr. Bassing had the ability to pay that, but more important than that, at $300 or $400 a month, we're talking roughly 50 years of spousal maintenance to balance out with the disproportionate award that the judge made. There is no way that Ms. Bassing is living to 120 years of age. So to suggest that the disproportionate award is just... One more thing just occurred to me. In addition to that, that $2,400 a month in income includes no rental income from the party's rental property in Ogilvie, Minnesota. The judge apparently ignored the fact that that could generate income, which would probably make up for the gap. And the reason the judge chose to ignore it was because, frankly, of his visceral dislike for Mr. Bassing, because... I'm sorry.
Not, if we brought your position.
Not in this instance, Your Honor, because it was the income earning capacity wasn't included in the appraised value. It was a market appraisal. So it was based on the market and the market appraisal as a single family residence.
Did your client submit that at the trial? I'm sorry to interrupt, but did your client submit some different appraisal at the trial of
there was
that
no
property?
There's no dispute about the value of the property, Your Honor. It's $265,000 based on its market value. That property can throw off, if she sold it, it would generate some income through interest, or it could throw off rental income. There was testimony at the trial that the respondent had no intention of renting it. She intended to allow her adult son to continue to live there and had no intention of charging him rent. Mr. Bassing, on the other hand, indicated that if he were awarded the property, he would expect his son to pay rent, and if his son did not pay him rent, he would sell the property and use the proceeds to support himself. The judge made it clear in his findings that he did not like that. He thought that was a bad attitude for Mr. Bassing to have, and that is part and parcel of why we're here. Because since 1974, fault has not been a consideration in marriage dissolutions in Minnesota. In 1978, the Minnesota legislature changed the marriage dissolution statutes further to make it clear that fault is not a consideration in property divisions in this case. Yet it is clear that the judge had more than a little bit of antipathy for Mr. Bassing in this case, and that colored the property division. This court has, I think, and the Minnesota Supreme Court have, I think, wisely not laid down any tracks for district court judges to follow in property divisions. The statute requires that the division be equitable. The court has, however, set out some guideposts to guide judges. We know that it doesn't require an exactly arithmetically equal division, but nonetheless, the division has to remain fair if it is not arithmetically equal. There are a series of decisions that are cited at page 19 of my brief, and those decisions typically hold that an equal division of the marital estate is appropriate in long-term marriages. That's the presumption. The Ellesmere case, which I've quoted at page 20 of my brief, suggests, at least in long-term marriages, that absent an extraordinary circumstances, a disproportionate division of the marital estate is not appropriate. Well, 50 years is certainly a long-term marriage. There are no disparities between these parties' situations, and the presumption is an equal division or something close to it. The judge was aware of that. That's why he tried to justify the disproportionate division based on not awarding spousal maintenance and based on declining to award sanctions. But for that justification to be valid, the set-off had to be roughly equivalent so that the dissolution distribution was still roughly equitable and fair. It wasn't anywhere close to equivalent. The judge made no finding on what his spousal maintenance award would have been to respondent, and in fact, it's our position that she was entitled to no award at all. The judge made no finding on what her sanctions would have been, and the record makes it clear that any sanctions that were awarded could have only been a fraction of the disproportionate property award. And beyond that, and I don't want to get into the mire of arguing specific valuations made by the judge, but the nature of the disproportionate award in this case was, if anything, masked by some of the property valuations that the judge made. I mentioned the $19,400 in marital funds taken by respondent and paid to her attorney. They're completely left off the ledger by the trial judge. He didn't include them at all. It's as if the money entirely disappeared. My client was awarded a $32,000 bank account at Bank of the West. The only problem with that was the account didn't exist. It had been used to pay the party's tax obligations during the course of their separation. My client was awarded property or promissory notes valued by the judge at $126,667. Problem with that is those were the valuations 2 years earlier. By the time of trial, the value had declined to $76,842. When I challenged that in a post-trial motion, the judge said, well, your client had essentially denied the post-trial motion, saying that Mr. Bassing had the benefit of those funds during the course of the separation, so it was fair to value them at the higher amount. Unfortunately, that ignored trial testimony from the respondent herself that said that Mr. Bassing had used those funds to pay marital expenses throughout the course of the entire separation. So he didn't benefit from them. The parties jointly benefited from them. If those amounts had been corrected, the nature of the disproportionate award would have been roughly $100,000 larger than the trial judge acknowledged. Judges have discretion, but it's not unmitigated discretion. And they have to stay within the guideposts set out by this court. This particular judge did not do that, and this matter should be returned to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Perdue. Next, we'll hear from counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Rachel Farhi. I am with Barna Guzzi Steffen in Coon Rapids, Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of respondent Barbara Bassing. Appellant has requested that your honors reverse and remand the trial court's decisions in valuing certain assets and the marital property division in this case. Respondent respectfully requests that your honors affirm the trial court's decisions. This case primarily concerns the wide discretion that trial courts have in valuing assets and dividing assets, and credibility determinations, and the conduct of Mr. Bassing during the litigation, not marital misconduct. The parties in this dissolution were married for approximately 50 years. During the marriage, they amassed a marital estate of about $2.5 million. This was comprised of pensions, investment accounts, promissory notes, multiple parcels of real property, and substantial cash, over $500,000 of cash. In 2019, Mr. Bassing started divorce proceedings. For about a year, they engaged in formal discovery. In March of 2020, we all know that COVID hit, and that was one of the many reasons why resolution of this case was delayed. The matter came before the Honorable Judge Gibbs in Anoka County for trial in April of 2021. Both parties and multiple third-party witnesses testified. The trial court issued a decree in July of 2021 awarding my client about $250,000 more marital property than it awarded appellant. This division was about 55% to my client, 45% to appellant. Appellant motioned for amended findings in August of 2021. An order denying those motions was issued in December, and this appeal followed. Both regarding asset valuation and asset division, the standard of review is of utmost importance because the standard sets a really high bar. Your honors must review the trial court's decision, division of assets, and decide if there was an abuse of discretion or a misapplication of the law. To disturb Judge Gibbs' decision, your honors must find that his findings were, quote, against logic and facts in the record under CIRIC. Regarding valuation, assigning an asset of value is a finding of fact, and findings of fact cannot be disturbed unless they're clearly erroneous, according to Gumau. I'm not really sure how you say that case name. The trial court made detailed findings on why it awarded my client more of the marital estate. First, it did find a deficit in her budget justifying the need for spousal maintenance.
So with a 50-year... interrupt you just for a second? Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that the deficit for spousal maintenance purposes was nowhere close to the imbalance in the division of assets?
So a couple responses. First is factual because he keeps saying this number of 2,400, and I think what he's meaning is the gross income, which is both her Social Security and payments on a promissory note that were coming into her. So there was $1,200 from Social Security, and then the promissory note payments were, I think, about 1,187 or something like that. That doesn't include taxes, and it is proper to include taxes when you're doing a spousal maintenance analysis. So the few hundred dollars that he cites, it's going to be more than that because she's going to have to pay taxes. And the other thing is, he has said a couple times in his briefs that the extra award to her needs to be mathematically equivalent. There isn't actually case law saying that. It's not in the statute. It's not in the cases. So he can make that argument, and your honors can find that that should be the case policy-wise, but there just isn't authority supporting that position.
Why isn't the issue equitable and not equal? But isn't the goal quite often in the trial court to achieve equality?
Well, you just said equality, but the statute says equitable. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. But if we had $100,000 in cash and the trial court was going to divide it, there's really no question that it would be 50-50, isn't that true?
No, because under a couple of the cases, if there are extenuating circumstances, then you could...
Well, let's assume there's none. And you're a trial court judge looking at that, you're going to divide it down the middle.
Yes, if there are no extenuating circumstances. But in this case, there are. The need for maintenance and the conduct-based attorney's fees were the extenuating circumstances.
But how often do we have maintenance with this kind of asset? Marriage and both parties being well into retirement.
I've had cases with maintenance where people are in their 60s and 70s and both are retired, or one is retired and the other isn't. I don't have statistics, but it happens.
But that's usually a situation where the obligated spouse has a larger income stream, or the income stream potential, than the disadvantaged spouse.
It often is, but it doesn't have to be the case. And I think that the appellant doesn't need a larger income stream because there are marital assets from which you can award a lump sum for maintenance, and then his cash flow isn't affected. Does that make sense? And he also, I mean, he did have a large gap, not a large gap, but he had a gap in his income. So the trial court found that his income was about, I think, $2,100 or $2,200. And again, there are going to be some taxes taken out of that. But then it also found that his living expenses were only $1,500 a month. So even under your logic, there is a gap in his income from which he could have been ordered to pay spousal maintenance. The other thing is, when you're practicing family law practically, sometimes lump sums make more sense because of who the parties are. And I think in this case, this is not case law related, but I think it is a good idea sometimes to award lump sums so that the parties don't have to ever interact with each other again. Because after the sum is paid, you're done. I mean, if Judge Gibbs had ordered him to pay her $600 a month for until he died or until she died, they would have had a point of contact every month for potentially 10 plus years. And there might be enforcement issues, people stop paying their maintenance, all types of things can happen. And so I actually really prefer a lump sum in my practice if there is cash available to do that, and there was here.
One another consideration we at least used to do in family court when I was doing it is you don't want to discourage people from making the right choices in their personal life driven by whether they'll lose maintenance if they remarry or some other questions of that sort. But
yeah. Yeah. And I also, another thing that I thought of when you're talking about, well, is $250,000 or even $300,000-something, like he's arguing, is it too much? You have to consider what types of assets they received, because my client received, I think, over $500,000 worth of cash. And at 70 years old, I mean, I'm not a financial planner, but cash loses value over time, and we're in a very high inflation environment, and there is case law saying that when you're awarded property, and when you're awarded property, especially if you're going to be expected to use it for maintenance you would have received, you need to be a good steward of that property, and you need to invest it so that you're earning interest and it actually lasts you as long as it needs to. The problem with doing that is a lot of that case law talks about 40 people in their 40s and 50s, sometimes even 30s. And you can do that when you're younger, but when you're 70, I mean, are you going to invest $400,000 into the stock market and try to get 10% interest so that it lasts you? Or are you just going to keep the cash and actually use the cash? And so I think that this award with a pretty large pot of cash makes sense in that regard.
But those weren't reasons that were specifically articulated by the district court.
No, I was just trying to answer the question generally.
Yeah, okay.
And what do we do with the Ogilvy property? Because the judge did make some findings about wife didn't really want it, son's living there, son doesn't pay rent, wife doesn't want her son ousted from his place to live. And that value is about the excess value awarded.
It's about $220,000.
So what do we do with that? I mean, is that an appropriate consideration for the court in dividing marital assets?
I feel like this is the hardest question because I don't have case law saying what should have been done. I think it goes back to the trial court is a court of equity, and it has to do what's fair. And they have this property. Something has to be done with it. Wife is willing to reluctantly take it, and it has a value, and it has to be assigned this $200,000-something value. So it goes on her side of the balance sheet, but realistically, the son is probably just going to keep living there, and again, I'm getting into things that weren't actually findings, and it's not case law, but he might end up inheriting it. I don't know what appellant would have done with the property if he had taken it, but it's got to go to someone, or it has to be sold. I mean, the trial court also had the power to sell it and to award someone cash. It could have awarded appellant more cash. And I honestly think that Judge Gibbs just did the compassionate thing. And I would say that compassion and looking at the family structure is part of what is equitable. I mean, there's also case law explaining why judges have such wide discretion in family law cases, and often they say, well, the reason why we can't have a formula or a one-size-fits-all deal is because every family is different. Every couple is different. Some of them have kids, some don't. Some have health issues, some don't. You can't, and this speaks to your question, you really can't just do 50-50 down the middle in a lot of situations, and I think this was just something that Judge Gibbs had to wrestle with, and he made what he thought was a fair decision. I can turn to the issue of asset valuation really quick, namely promissory notes totaling about $130,000. He argues that the value should have been lower because they continued to pay out between formal discovery happening in 2019 and the trial, which happened over a year later. He also argues that a few of them were either omitted from the balance sheet or included when they shouldn't have been. There are a couple cases that are very on point here. Bender, Grigsby, and Baker are the main ones. Under all three of those cases, the trial court's decisions were proper. In Bender, the main holding was actually that using different valuation dates for different assets is proper if there's support for why the court made those decisions. And you'll notice in the trial court's order, he has at least a sentence or two explaining why he valued each asset the way he did. Some of them he just used the initial hearing date like the statute says. I mean, there was one asset, my client's condo, that he valued in 2021 simply because she bought it in 2021. So what else could you possibly do? It didn't exist in 2019.
But shouldn't some of these be adjusted based on payments made for the marital estate in the interim between the start of the case and...
I think you can. The problem is that he didn't prove that. He said so, but in the if you read closely both of the decree and the post-decree order, it says that his testimony was conflicting. One of appellant's briefs actually pointed out that for the most part, the money was used for marital expenses. So we just don't know how the money was used. I mean, it wouldn't have been hard for him to just submit a year's worth of bank statements and show the money coming in and going out, paying mortgages and utilities and everything else, and he didn't do that. So he didn't meet his burden on that one. In Grigsby, I just wanted to point out Grigsby because I think it shows the power that the trial court has. It actually did a complete redo of the entire case and set a whole new valuation date for everything because a marital asset worth almost $2 million was acquired after the trial happened. The difference between that case and this one is the amounts that we're talking about that potentially need to be corrected here are maybe $100,000. It's a few percentage points. In Grigsby, it was one asset that came in that was marital that was worth more than twice the entire marital estate at the time of trial. So it's just not in the same ballpark, essentially. My time is running out, so I'll just say the record doesn't support appellant's notions regarding marital misconduct or judicial animosity. He's speculating on those. And most of the law that he cites about marital misconduct is irrelevant or misquoted. Statutes and case law support an affirmation of all the trial court's decisions.
Thank you, Ms. Frey.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I often think when I listen to rebuttals that they're just a shotgun blast, and well, this is going to be the same thing. I'm going to respond to several statements that were made by opposing counsel. First, she understandably relies on the judge's wide discretion and says that the judge was best equipped to determine the credibility and the conduct of the parties. I don't disagree with any of that. That's pretty clear. However, conduct isn't a criteria here for dividing the marital estate disproportionately. If it was, we didn't need to have this amendment to the statute in 1978, and we can ignore the Miller case that says that you can't consider a party's conduct in the division of marital assets. With regard to claim that extenuating circumstances warrant a disproportionate division of the marital estate in this case, the extenuating circumstance identified, again, was Mr. Bassing's conduct. That's not what this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court mean when they say that in a long-term marriage, a disproportionate award is appropriate only when there are extenuating circumstances. What the court is talking about is where one party is in greater need than the other, whether for medical reasons or lack of income or some other reason. And that simply is not present in this case. With respect to the argument that it was appropriate to award, would have been appropriate to award spousal maintenance in this case, because Mr. Bassing had an income of $2,100 a month and only $1,500 a month in expenses, I would note that Mr. Bassing actually submitted a budget, I believe it's Exhibit 2, which has monthly expenses of $2,668. The $1,500 monthly budget claim is an interesting one. It's the respondent's explanation of what she thought her husband should be allowed to spend every month. And that's addressed in my reply brief. With regard to the argument that because the respondent received a highly liquid portion of the marital estate, that increases her need for spousal maintenance, I'd submit she has it exactly 180 degrees wrong. Spousal maintenance awards are justified when a party receives an illiquid division, which prevents them from using that asset to produce an income stream. When a party receives a liquid asset or a liquid division, it actually decreases, not increases, their need for spousal maintenance. I would also note that in pointing out that the value of the Ogilvie property is virtually equivalent to the disproportionate amount of the award, Judge Siegel has actually pointed out my exact point. The judge made it clear that he didn't like the choice Mr. Bassing was going to make if awarded that property. He didn't like the fact that Mr. Bassing would require his son to pay, adult son to pay rent, or that he would sell the property and perhaps the adult son would face homelessness. The trial judge thought that was a bad attitude. He didn't like what it he didn't like it, so he decided to punish Mr. Bassing by making a disproportionate award of the property, by giving the property to his wife and showing Mr. Bassing what the judge thought of him. That's fault.
Can you address real quickly what opposing counsel said about on the valuations, that the wrong valuations were used, that your client just failed to put forward sufficient evidence, and it's a credibility determination?
That's on the promissory.
By the district court.
Yeah, that relates to the promissory notes, and she's saying he didn't prove it was used for marital purposes. I would note at page 23 of my brief, at note 14, I quoted from her client's own testimony in which she acknowledged that Mr. Bassing had used those funds to pay marital debt during the course of the marriage. Specifically, it's a question. Since your separation in 2019, Mr. Bassing was paying all of the utility expenses, the property taxes, the homeowner's insurance, the telephone payments. He is making all of the basic payments for both you and he until you moved into your new home, correct? Answer, yes. She agreed with that that statement at trial. I don't know what more Mr.
Evidence in the record about what those amounts actually were? I mean, is there? Because otherwise, if you just got this admission, but the court doesn't know the amounts, that creates a problem for the court.
There is, Your Honor, but it's not with the kind of clarity that you might hope for. Basically, what they did is they dumped all, that's probably a bad word for me to use, they placed all of the bank statements in their record which had that information, but I don't know that they ever actually did any kind of a formal accounting. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.